do a roll call?
Tom Moore, Judy O'Connor.
Here.
Joe Omo Osagie.
Here.
Did I do it right?
Yeah.
Osagie. Elaine Palencia.
Here.
Kyle Patterson.
Here.
Julian Rappaport.
Here.
Ann Robin.
Here.
Margaret White.
Here.
Susan Fowler.
Here.
Okay. As vice president last year, I will be running the meeting until we decide who will be president for the year. And I will note a positive thing on the meeting today. There are no decision memos. So it's one of those rare occasions where we should be able to move without too much tension. We have some citizen input, public participation, I believe. And I'm not sure if you're here for citizen participation input, we will ask you to come up to the mic at the center table. And for each topic, there's 5 minutes max, so that we can make sure that everybody has an opportunity for input. Okay. Is there any input? Okay, I was wrong. There is no input. Great. Additions to the agenda. Do we have additions? Anybody? Okay. Any information that you want to share from the CCDB this morning?
The DDB met at noon today. We had actually a fairly long meeting for such a light agenda, so watch out, because your agenda is even lighter. It just gives you room for discussion. So, anyway, they approved minutes and they approved the financials. And otherwise, we had a presentation on the first 6 months of a newly funded program there. We're going to do the same thing tonight with a newly funded program. This is a new requirement in contracts, which are sort of special initiatives or new programs. I thought it went very well this morning or at noon. And what else? Oh, and there was a guest today who is a consultant working with Developmental Services Center and Community Choices on Employment First. He's a specialist in customized or integrated employment for people with developmental disabilities. And he just happened to be in town, so he presented on the Employment First project, which is funded by the DDB. So, anyway.
And just for the new members to know, you're always welcome to sit in on the DD board meeting if you have an interest or curiosity about the business. We do meet together for study sessions, and we do often co-fund issues. So it's always posted with ours, so just feel free. Okay. Approval of the Mental Health Board minutes. Comments? Margaret.
I just have one comment on the section on the it's on page 5, the anti-stigma event. The second paragraph, we really didn't, that really wasn't the focus. That was added afterwards. So I would say to just say it was a part of our anti-stigma efforts.
So you're recommending deleting
just the center paragraph. Piece. Just say it's a part. It's more editorialized.
Okay.
I'm not clear.
Where it says centerpiece? Is that
just say it's.
Where is it?
It's on page 5.
On page 5. It's the second paragraph.
Under anti-stigma event. It's.
Roger Ebert's film. Do you want to read what you'd like it to say?
Just just say Roger Ebert's Film Festival is part of our anti-stigma efforts in Champaign County.
And just delete the rest of the paragraph?
I don't care. I'm just saying just part of it. We didn't really say that at the board meeting.
Mm-mm.
No.
Not that it was the centerpiece. So we talked about the expo as well.
So is the word centerpiece the
issue.
Main issue?
Mm-hmm. It's just we didn't, that wasn't said at the meeting, and the minutes are to reflect the meeting.
It's just copied from the demo. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Are there any other comments to the minutes? So we'll be asking if you approve the minutes as amended briefly by Margaret. All those in favor?
We need a motion, right?
Oh, we need a motion. Sorry.
I need to approve
Thank
as
you.
Amended by Margaret.
Could you just clarify what the change is?
I think she struck the two words,
the centerpiece,
centerpiece mm-hmm. and substitute the word part, P-A-R-T.
Okay, great, thank you.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Kyle. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. President's comments. Okay, well, I'm vice president, so I'll just do my comments from the transition into the new year. So it's a new year. We have a new executive director. We're likely to have some new staff at some point this year due to transitions of other staff. We have two new board members whom I'd like to welcome and encourage you to network with the other board members. You may feel a bit overwhelmed when you see the first set of proposals to look at. It's normal. Just we'll be talking about it, and feel free to pick up the phone and call Lynn or Mark or whomever if you've got questions, because it's a quick learning curve. And we do make funding decisions by the end of May. So, and the proposals come in basically end of February?
February 10.
So there are a lot of new issues in the community, as well as the ongoing old issues. The issues that I've heard about most recently and most prominently are the men's emergency shelter. And I suspect housing itself is a major issue in our community. And then other issues we've heard about, the continuing concern over gun violence. And we'll be hearing a little bit about one program that's addressing that today. I would like to just encourage members of the board to feel free to communicate with one another via email or phone. We have each other's phone numbers. And if you've got a question or a concern, it's certainly appropriate to call a board member. Open Meetings Act says that we cannot meet as a group of more than two. Mm-hmm. So saying, let's get together for coffee and let's see if we can have three of us come would be prohibited, but certainly not phone calls. Mm-hmm. We'll be talking just a little bit, or considering as we move forward, if there are any conflict of interest issues related to the grants that are funded. And I bring it up only as a reminder that if you or a family member is directly benefiting from one of the programs, then you would be in a conflict of interest and should be able to recuse yourself from voting on that program. And we will have to talk about how we handle that in the Mental Health Board, because we've been voting on tiers, and certainly you wouldn't want to be not included in the tier vote, but we might pull proposals out. So it really hadn't occurred to me that there were potential conflicts of interest until Margaret raised her involvement with the Macy Foundation. And then I thought about my son's involvement with a program that's funded by the DD board, not Mental Health Board. But I probably won't vote if it were on the Mental Health Board. So something to think about as we move forward. Lynn has offered to have a study session. And as you remember from those who are returning board members, she came up with dates last fall that run through this calendar year, or through July 1st, and for study sessions. And I think you have a study session potentially scheduled for next week. Mm-hmm. Right. Am I jumping ahead?
No, they're not listed on.
Okay, that's okay. Yeah, that's okay. Not a problem. Well, I will let Lynn talk about it when we move over to executive director's comments, but wanted to also encourage you, if you feel overwhelmed by the proposal review process, if you have ideas for how to make it more efficient or to improve the discussion process, that certainly could come up at the review session. And I remember, Julian, you talked about, well, why don't we break it up into parts and do first and second level reviews, reviewing not all of the proposals at the same level of effort, but ensuring that each proposal does get a review and does have someone who can speak about it. So that was, that's a potential.
So I have some thoughts about that further, but I don't know when the appropriate time to discuss it is. I did mention some ideas to Lynn, but I don't want to necessarily talk about it right now.
Okay.
I'm happy to talk anytime.
All right.
Let me know when's the right time.
Okay. When we get to old business, we could do that. Is there an interest in the study session next week?
Yes.
Pending what Lynn says.
We could. So this is the.
Turn it over to Lynn.
This is. Comments too. Just. That's a really unusually smooth transition. So it is under old business 15A. There's a meeting schedule and allocation process timeline. So we could talk about it then. We could move it to then. But since we're talking about it now, what I've come up with today is we have the room next door on January 25th, which is next Wednesday. And we could start as early as 5. And I know Kyle can't be here because he has this room. But maybe you could sneak in. What we could do is talk about the application review process as it is, the system enhancements that we just finished building to try to make this a more inclusive process, and then ideas such as the one that Julian and I talked about this morning and that you're referencing, and any other ideas you might have for making the application review process a little bit smoother for you and maybe deeper involvement if you're interested in that. So that was kind of what we came up with. We have the room from 5 to 8, so anything in there,
okay.
Any time in there.
I would be interested in that. I think it's a good idea. 5 is too early,
mm-hmm.
And going to 8 is too late.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could do a study session that would be, I think, of value to me of approximately 1 hour,
mm-hmm.
Possibly a little bit more than an hour, but not a lot more, maybe 5:30 to 7, I would be interested in that.
Can we take just a straw vote to see who's interested?
I'm interested, but I have a conflict.
Okay.
I teach a class.
Okay.
You can't.
Can I just wanted to clarify the time?
5:30 to 7?
I can't stay past 7. So
okay.
I was happy to hear you say that.
Okay. So for people who are not able to attend, you could send me ideas or comments about this, and we can share them with the group. Okay, so the rest of my comments. So I wanted to mention the system enhancements, but we can do that in detail next week. And I wanted to mention study sessions, and we just did, so that's good. The only other things on my list are the organizational assessment is underway, and many of you have been involved with that. We sped up the timeline because of another vacancy in the office, thought that it was important to get this piece done, and so we've really been focused internally for a while, for the last couple of weeks, and have made a lot of progress. So I'm looking forward to wrapping that up in the next few weeks. The expo, we've been talking, and I believe the steering committee is going to try to meet in a couple of weeks to talk about actually changing the expo from an October event to an April event. There's a long list of reasons that they think that would be an advantage to the event. So we'll probably get more detail on planning around the expo next month from Barb Bresner. So just I wanted to keep everybody, that's a big change. So
Ebertfest, Christie Clinic Marathon, Boneyard Arts Festival is all in April.
Yes, and same week too, yes. So the the Ebertfest is actually it would first expo and then the Ebertfest, like right after that. And then the marathon is on the Saturday of the Ebertfest. So the festival, actually Chaz Ebert picked a film for the Anti-Stigma Alliance and is very excited about it. I know about the film. I can't share too much about it, but it will lend itself to some of the things we've talked about for a long time and not been able to do, including high school screening or some inclusion of high school students, even middle school students. The star of the film is coming to town, so that would be maybe make it extra interesting for high school students, and it has a relationship to athletics too. So there are some possibilities there that I hope we can really take advantage of this year.
So are you talking about Disability Expo being this April 2017 or 2018?
Right. Thank you. You're right. I got it. I got confused, but you're right. It's next April. Thank you.
Okay. So instead of October 2017, it would be April 2018, which gives more time for planning. Okay. I thought that was a little fast. Okay.
I got it mixed up because we're going to start talking about why to move it in a couple of weeks. And one of the main reasons is that there's so much going on in October that they usually have a choice of pretty much one weekend. And so they thought they might be able to get more flexibility in April, but certainly not this year. So I'm glad that I misspoke on that. Anyway, the other thing on my list is to introduce the new board members, Joe Omoasagie. First time ever I've said it right. And Kyle Patterson, who is our county board liaison. And welcome back to Julian Rappaport, who is reappointed. And that's the end of my comments.
Lynn, would it be all right if we, not to put you on the spot, but just asked Kyle and Joe? Mm-hmm. To give us a few words about your interest on the mental health board and what it is that you do, so that we get to know you a bit more. And
I have worked in the field of mental health for close to 30 years. Started out at King's School as an outreach worker, and worked at a developmental services center and mental health center before it became all the different alliterations of names. I currently am a counselor at Parkland and a personal counselor, but also I do academic advising. I also teach a couple of psychology classes when I have a time. What else do I do? But my interest in this field is professional, but also very personal, because I lost a family member to suicide, and so mental health is very important to me.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm Kyle Patterson. I am the, as she said, the county board liaison. I serve on the county board in District 7. I just was sworn in December. A little bit about myself. I've lived my whole life here. I don't have probably quite as much professional experience as our other new member, but I've worked for probably about a year and a half working with youth in a behavioral health capacity. And really kind of my take on being on the board is that I was, to my knowledge, the only county board member who does have, you know, any experience in working with mental health and behavioral health. I also actually more recently started working at an elementary school with children with developmental disabilities, behavioral disabilities. And also over the summer, I also work at Parkland for the migrant education program. But yeah, that's...
Julian, you're newly appointed, but do you have anything new that you'd like to report about yourself? We don't want to leave you out.
I suppose if there's a written report in your packet, if you have questions, I'd be happy to field, do my best to answer them.
I just want to thank Mark for doing the written report, and also our colleague over here for doing written reports, because they're very helpful to me. I can see what you're doing, and I appreciate you both have very different writing styles, but I can appreciate how busy you are and what you're doing. And so thank you very much.
The document that the students completed is in the packet. It is an ongoing and can be updated. So if you have additional corrections or any information, please feel free to email me. You're welcome.
Chandra, do you know how have you guys decided how you're going to distribute this? I think it's amazing, and I know that a lot of school social workers will be extremely grateful.
So that can be added to the list is school social workers. Someone this morning asked that we distribute it to the libraries, and then a couple of other people had asked for it directly. And then it will be also put on our website as well.
Thank you.
If anyone sees any omissions, commissions, feel free to contact Chandra, and she will do her best to make it perfect. And thanks to the students for taking on a task that was very functional for the county. Okay. We have no consultant report today. Do we have any board-to-board reports from members of the board where you've gone and visited an agency and would like to share any information? Julian.
So I attended the meeting that Mark refers to of the crisis intervention team with the police that takes place over at Rosecrans and with various social service people, and I think Mark mentioned that they were collecting data on how much they go out, the police were, on how much they go out to deal with a crisis. They go out a lot to deal with a crisis, and what was interesting to me, though, was that there wasn't any information on how often they get assistance from the crisis intervention people who we're funding. So I hope that we can get some information about that in the future. And maybe Mark has a better understanding of this data than I do. He probably does. But I guess what I'm looking for is trying to figure out whether or not or how we can make, I'm saying in a positive way, which I mean it in a positive way, is how we can be sure that the law enforcement people are getting the most amount of consultation possible, given our resources, when they're dealing with people experiencing a mental health emergency. They work hard at training themselves, but I think they often would benefit from, and I think that's what we're trying to do, is generate social service support for them. So I'm hoping we can get maybe a little more information about that coming up. Do you have something to add to what I'm saying?
I've been asking for a little more detail from Rosecrans on the we fund the Crisis Access and Benefits Engagement Program. It's got a number of different activities associated with it. It's a $250,000 contract or thereabouts. But I have been asking them for a little additional detail in terms of crisis team contacts and involvement with law enforcement, as well as the location of where those and it's in terms of what's been reported so far, it's a very small percentage of crisis team contacts that occur that also involve law enforcement. I've also asked for and been provided information about where the crisis team contacts are occurring. I don't think it'll come as much of a surprise, but the very vast majority of those occur at the emergency departments at the hospitals. There are a few that occur at the Walnut location and a small number that occur out in the community. And then I've also asked about, in terms of the contacts at the emergency department, how many of those contacts are with people from Champaign County and outside of Champaign County. So that's pretty much the information or the data I've asked for, and they are providing that. Quite a bit of that is new for this year, but it is additional information and detail. In terms of our investment in crisis, we fund about 10% of each crisis team member's time. In terms of how our contract is the program is structured in terms of what portion of costs we are paying. I would imagine that might be part of our conversation next week at the study session in terms of the analysis of the applications that occurs. But that is one of the things we look at. Anyway, that's the data I have. Rosecrans is working on improving their data collection in terms of their relationship with law enforcement and documenting that. I think they're something that isn't necessarily quantifiable is the relationship that has been fostered through like the Crisis Intervention Team Steering Committee, the meetings that occur with law enforcement, as well as crisis and other involve stakeholders, that the relationship that is being developed and fostered through that communication between the emergency services manager and the crisis coordinator at Rosecrans with various representatives from law enforcement.
Okay.
Great. Any other board to board? So this is also the time of year where you've spent a year visiting an agency or a board, and we have more agencies than we have people. And so I'm going to pass out the choices where you could be a liaison for an agency. You don't have to decide today. Think about it, and I believe the assignments happen in February. If you know which group or groups you would like to be involved with, feel free to. Would it be all right if they emailed you, Stephanie?
Sure.
To let Stephanie know, and we will. We usually don't have trouble with many people wanting to be with the same agency, but we try and. Because of the number of agencies and the 9 board members to disperse so that we don't have multiple board members at the same agency. So if you just would email your preference, to Stephanie, then we'll probably email your first, second, and third preference. Then we can sort it out and make sure that there's a good match. If you've been with the same agency for several years, it might be a good thing to move to another agency just to allow some fresh perspective. And in addition to that, as you're looking at the agencies and thinking about which one you might want to visit, Lynn provided us with County Mill Health Board guidelines for board-to-board liaisons. You know, we get this at the beginning when we're first appointed, and then 4 years later, we don't really remember. So thank you for...
Those are from Stephanie.
Thank you, Stephanie, for making those available again, the guidelines. Okay. Agency information. Do we have any information from the agencies who are here?
Good evening. I'm Andy Golchitsky. I'm the Executive Director of Community Service Center in Rantoul. Just thought I'd give you a couple of updates on what's been happening in our neck of the woods. Since December, we've had Courage Connection there about 5 days a week now. And it's been a real benefit. There's been a couple of cases where it was a situation of life and death, and they were able to help out and connect people with services. So we're very pleased to see them using our facility on a regular basis. We also have choices that have been coming. Their staff have been coming up here to provide some services to youth, as well as Crosspoint. These are just wanted to point out newer organizations that haven't used our facilities on a regular basis prior to that. For Courage Connection, it's been a few years. But the other ones, so we're trying to do what we can to connect people in Northern Champaign County with services available in Champaign-Urbana, but hopefully the resources being able to be brought up to Rantoul. The other thing is that we're planning on a social service / mental health resource fair for the community. We're working with the U of I School of Social Work and the Rantoul City Schools to put together something probably sometime in April before it gets too close to graduation time. So good things are happening in Rantoul, and we're trying to provide as much access to services as we can.
Great. Questions? Thank you very much.
There you go. Sorry. While we are not a new organization to the Mental Health Board, I wanted to just have the opportunity to stop in this evening and to just share with this board that as of tomorrow, January 19th, we will celebrate our seventh year of having our doors open. And when I say that we are a grassroots organization, we literally started from cleaning the building out to having 7 children for our first 3 months, and now we are serving over a combined total of between 80 and 85 students in all of our programs from kindergarten through high school. We are celebrating our third year of having a college and career readiness program. And I used to always report that we were an after-school program. However, now we are after school. We are school out days, such as yesterday someone said, oh, you guys were open. We are open when the teachers are having teacher institute days, and we are also open this summer. This past summer, we had 9 weeks of being open 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. We continue to have a strong focus of our social-emotional development, our academic development, recreational opportunities for children, as well as family support initiatives. I know that often we don't have the opportunity with our applications to put in a flyer, so I just kind of brought one of our flyers to share with the board and take the opportunity to welcome all board members. I know it's a good night. We have two new board members and are returning to just stop by any time. However, if you stop by after 3 o'clock, you will have about, on a daily basis, between 60, 65, or 70 children at our center every evening who primarily is engaged in academics when they first get there. But after that, we partner with Cooperative Extension. We have Boy Scouts. We have a cooking club. We have lots of activities going on for the students who are attending the center. So we are located in what many people may remember as Harley-Davidson's building, right next to DART, or the former Solo Cup. So we are there anytime that you like to stop in. Please stop in and view our program and see all the kids. Tomorrow they'll probably think that there is a birthday party going on, and it will be a celebration because we are going to have balloons and cupcakes to celebrate 7 years of having our doors open for the center. So thank you very much for the opportunity to just come and share some information. Any questions? Yes.
Is there, how do you get your students? How are they referred to you?
It's two ways. Well, there's a lot of different ways, to be honest with you. But the main is our after-school programming. The students primarily come from Urbana School District. All of the schools have our flyers in them, registration forms. Some have just been word of mouth. The great thing is that we can see right now many of our students who started out with us, who were in kindergarten. This is like the class I'm just following because now they're in middle school. Although we've graduated students who've kind of come along and joined at different times, we have a core group of students who've been with us since kindergarten, first, second grade, that are continuing with us. So those students just continue. We also have a list of students who've been referred because of the additional supports that they need, whether that's academic support or whether that means that family is in need of safe place, safe space after school. We do share, make certain that this is correct, in terms of capacity, Courage Connection across the street from us, that's a situation where regardless of our numbers, our doors are always open. So if there are families that come in and we may think that we're at capacity, we never turn down the students from over across the street from us. We have students who right now are in our intensive literacy program, and those are the students who are performing maybe a grade level or two below where they should be. So at least 3 days a week they are working with. Right now we have 4 retired teachers, RTAs, and our social workers that's at our center at least 3 to 4 times a week. So, again, the referrals could come from families, the community, but we do get individual specific referrals for homework and other services for families.
And is there a fee for students?
Yes, we have a $25 per month fee for the students. However, we do work on what we would say a sliding fee scale. And in some situations, I can tell you, is well documented, sometimes $25 is not affordable. So in that case, we may have some students who aren't paying anything, but they're on our books. So we don't turn a student down or a child down because they can't. We are an approved site by the USDA and the State Board of Ed for the meal service. So whether we are after school or summer, we do provide a full meal to the students every day that they're there. Yes.
Go ahead.
I just want to say thank you, Janice. I've just known Janice since the beginning, and she's been very helpful in projects I've worked on, and you're just making an incredible difference in lives of kids.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you, Margaret.
And I just wanted to ask, do you have a waiting list? Have you been able to expand to meet the needs, or is that something that will have to be a consideration in the future?
Actually, we do have a waiting list. We have a waiting list, and not only do we have a waiting list, I'm probably going to kind of let something out the bag. We are currently working with some space downtown Urbana that we are going to make a transition for our middle school and high school students in a different location so that we could serve more elementary students, because we are finding, I mean, even with some of our middle school students who may be performing at an elementary level, we just want to give the right space for the services to happen with them too. And right now, like I said, we are very blessed to have retired teachers and social workers who are giving of their time to work with us to provide that extra time and energies with those students. Yes. Okay. Thank you all very much. Okay.
Hello, I'm Becca Obachowski with Community Choices. I just wanted to take a moment this evening to sort of let you guys know or to just address some of the eligibility criteria that's built into the provisions of many of the contracts. This seems like a good night to do it again with the new board members here, and I know that this board addresses a lot of different community issues, so I thought I would just bring this one that affects folks with developmental disabilities and the programs that we run for them specifically. So Community Choices was founded in part by people and families who were affected by developmental disability that may or may not include an intellectual disability. So this includes people with autism, also people with CP, and often people with these diagnoses can very easily fall through some of the cracks where they have a disability, but the programs that are available are not necessarily designed to meet their needs, or they don't qualify for the programs which could potentially meet their needs. So many of the programs that Community Choices created had these individuals in mind as people who really did need support, but maybe weren't being served by what was available currently in our community. So one of those that we have, for instance, is with most of our programs, we try to make it finite, where we come in and we provide sort of a great deal of support up front and then sort of try to back that support away so that person is able to sort of fill it in with the natural supports that they would need in order to be independent. This is particularly true in our employment department and in our community living department. The Mental Health Board here obviously is one of the funders specifically of our employment department. So to participate in these programs, one of the provisions in the contracts says that to participate in the programs, the individuals must roll on the PUNS database, which is what people use to get access to state-funded services. And so people can be eligible, so that it's like a pre-screening where people can be eligible for the pre-screening, but then if their name were to be drawn to get state services, the provisions become a little bit more strict, and they may look at things like IQ, not in every case, but sometimes that can be a big determiner. So this leaves folks with autism or with these other disabilities, which are defined as developmental disabilities, but may not include that intellectual disability, really sort of at risk of or liable to lose both the potential for those state services, as well as the potential of losing some of the services that are paid for with our county dollars. So currently, Community Choices, we have about, so we're run as a cooperative. So we serve not just people who are part of the cooperative, but we have about 65 members who have disabilities currently. Of those 65 members, we look down our list, and probably about 20, so almost a third, are people who we think would probably be at great danger of not qualifying for those state-funded services. So if they were to be pulled from that list and that were to happen, one of the other sort of consequences of that could be that they would also lose access to the programs that are funded through the county. So we just wanted to bring this to your attention. Yes?
What does the special provision say in this year's contract? Have it with you?
I don't have it with me, but for the employment and for our community living contracts, it says that the person must be enrolled in the PUNS database.
Doesn't it also say that they would be determined to have eligibility according to IDHS DDD criteria? Because that's supposed to be in the special provisions, and I checked the at least the community living contract last week, and it was in there.
Okay.
So everybody that you're serving should already have been deemed eligible or not.
Right.
By the past, you know, the ISC unit.
Yeah, no, and that's accurate, and that is the case for the people that we're serving. I think the concern that I have is simply that then if that person would be to be pulled and say, hey, do you want home-based support services? Do you want waiver-funded services through the state? And they had to go through all of the eligibility criteria to actually get those, which then becomes a bit more stringent when you. Okay, that hasn't been my impression, but I will investigate. Yeah. Anyway, so I think, you know, again, just the concern would be to make sure that as a board that funds services for people with developmental disabilities, that there still be a door left open for those people who maybe have autism and really need those perhaps finite supports, and to create a way for them to continue to get them. Regardless of what some of the state definitions are. And I know that some of this is, you guys are sort of beholden to what the state says, but.
Well, do you want to give the context for this?
Yes, but I would like to just say that we got a letter, I got a letter in the mail in January from the PASS agency, which is the Regional Planning Commission, for one of my children who is on the PUNS list. And it said it was time for a reevaluation to see if he was still eligible to be on the PUNS list. So I think most of us know that it's one of those things that gets reevaluated. Mm-hmm. We would certainly hope that if we're deemed eligible now, we wouldn't suddenly face a stricter criteria if our name was actually drawn.
Right.
So that after, would be upsetting.
Yeah, that was the thought of a large group of stakeholders who worked on this at the state level, the Life Choices Project. One of the recommendations of the Life Choices Project was to do exactly that. Don't let people be sitting on that waiting list without some idea of whether they would actually receive services after 8 years of being on the waiting list and finally being selected. The state has, to my knowledge, not made that the rule, but it's sitting in front of them. So in this community, we have a contract with the ISC unit, who's responsible for making those, for doing the, it's called a pre-admission screening, so for doing the pass and then submitting it to the state. So because that's the closest we can get to the state's process, we're paying them to do that upon enrollment with PUNS or upon re-enrollment. So, and, okay, we've got to make the long story short. The statute establishing the 377 mentions the DD board, right, mentions that it operates under the rules of DHS. This board's statute also mentions the rules of DHS. So because the rules of DHS are in your statutes, we look at the rules of DHS around what is a DD. So that's where we take the eligibility criteria, and that's in your funding guidelines. The reference is to DHS Development Division of DD criteria, and that's the PASS process. So that's, I have a memo that I'm going to present next month to the DD board on this, on the origin of the criteria. What we've been trying to do over the last 2 years through the contracts is make sure that everybody gets seen again now that there's an opportunity to get that presumptive eligibility, and also because the state changed the way it was deciding on people who have autism spectrum disorders. They used to just say no if the IQ level was above 70, but they're not doing that anymore. And so since the practice changed, we thought, here's a great opportunity. What we did before that was even available was we kind of relied on a parallel system, and that was sort of, it was placing a lot of power in our hands to make eligibility determinations, which I think is a real conflict of interest for us. So that's why we're where we at today, and I would like to get some idea of the impact of these rules on the agencies. And so Becca has actually come up with numbers, which is very helpful. So I would like to see everybody made eligible. But
yeah. Any other questions? Thank you.
Any other agency presentations? Okay, seeing no one jumping up. And Lynn, I will say that this was one of the largest, longest financial information sections we've had for a while. It covers two months.
Yeah.
Covers 2 months. Questions? Elaine?
I just have one question because I wasn't on the board when all of the excess money was, that whole contract was in force. So I just wanted to ask about the last item on page 43 where over $327,000 is returned, an unused grant from that program. And I just wondered if you could just quickly revisit that for me and anybody else who doesn't know about that.
And staff might correct me, but my understanding is this is carryover money from the first year. We didn't receive it until the last year. We requested permission to use it for some of the items that were agreed to in the sustainability plan for, you know, continuing to support the system of care for youth and families. And the answer was no, return the money. So we tried, but we had to return it. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think and this was not my specific area, but my recollection is very similar to what Lynn just described in that during the first year, there was carryover money that we requested to be able to use that was denied. Then in the seventh year, this past year, while the cooperative agreement was being closed out by the state, they discovered that they had $347,000 in carryover money. So they sent it to us. It was the money that we had from the first year that we had asked to use that had been denied. The state found themselves holding that money. They sent it to us and said, you know, spend it. We didn't, before we were going to spend it, and I believe this was during Peter's tenure, he asked for approval from the feds to use that money. And the feds said, no, you cannot. And so we returned the money. So so I think that's pretty much what you said.
It's very strange looking in all of our budget reports. And so I've had the question before and kind of fumbled.
We didn't have the money to spend for sure. Other questions? Okay. Moving on then to. We have to approve it. Action is requested. Thank you, Elaine.
Sure.
Can I have a motion to approve the financial?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, moving on to new business. New business will involve the election of officers. And so I will open the meeting for nominations for president and for vice president / secretary.
I nominate you, Susan Fowler, for president, board president.
Second.
Any other nominations?
I nominate, probably should have talked to these people, Elaine Valencia for vice president.
Second. Any other nominations? Okay. I'm willing. Are you willing, Elaine?
Yes, I'm willing to serve.
Okay. Knowing that we're both willing to serve, action is requested. So we have a nomination for Fowler and Palencia as president, vice president. Both of those have been seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Well, that's a relief.
Yay.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Okay, and this now allows us to move forward with the Fresh Start program presentation. This was one of the new contracts that we approved last year.
Okay. My voice carries, so I don't want to hurt anybody's ears. Good evening. I'm Carol Bradford. I'm the clinical director for Prairie Center's Urbana Outpatient and Intensive Outpatient Programs located at 718 Killarney Street in Urbana. And I will let my partner here introduce himself.
Hello, everyone. Dante Lotz. I'm the community service liaison for the CU Fresh Start initiative.
And we also have our support person there in the back. Gail Rainey, our CEO, is here with us as well. What I wanted to do is just start out, just in case there's anyone here that's not familiar with Prairie Center. Prairie Center has been in the community for 49 years, and we do have three counties that we serve, Champaign, Ford, and Vermilion. We have sites in each of those in Danville and Vermilion County. That particular site does outpatient and intensive outpatient services as well. And then we have a residential treatment facility located in Champaign on Hill Street, and then, of course, the Urbana location. We have a wide variety of services and programs that we provide, and CU Fresh Start is one of our newer ones, so that's the one we're going to share with you tonight, and a wide variety of funding sources as well. So CU Fresh Start grew out of community concern for some of the rise in the gun violence that's been occurring, shootings in our community. The Champaign Coalition had meetings and community concerns were shared, and they started looking at some of the initiatives across the country. And one of the ones that had gotten really good results in most of the communities that it has been implemented in is called the Don't Shoot program, which David Kennedy, if you haven't heard of him, he's written a book. I don't know the entire title, but it is it's called Don't Shoot. And he's done several interviews, so there's a lot of information available if you want to do more research on him that's available online. So we decided that we in this community, we wanted to call it Fresh Start, but it is based on the Don't Shoot anti-violence model. So it's basically a targeted approach to reduce gun violence that's built on bringing together a coalition of stakeholders. And you can go ahead and click. And it's basically designed to offer an alternative to the lifestyle that some of the young men that are involved in these shootings are living. So if we're saying to you, put your guns down, we don't want you shooting, we don't want people to be endangered, what's the alternative that we're offering them? And so that's kind of what it's built on. Where does Prairie Center come in on that? We do know that there's research out there that shows that oftentimes when there is violence, gun violence, shootings, that there is some substance use occurring when those incidents occur, before, during, after. And so we have that connection with violence, crime, not only in the community but in the home, being associated with substance use or substance dependence. One of the things that's very important to Prairie Center is to work collaboratively with other community organizations and entities to address issues that impact our community and impact the type of clients that we serve who have substance abuse issues. And many of them have some involvement with the criminal justice system. And so that connection is there as well. We feel that by partnering up with the other stakeholders that we're not only addressing issues that impact the clients that Prairie Center serves, but also the community that our staff and our clients live in. We're all members of the community, and being able to be safe and have a community that we can be proud of is very important to us. So we're very excited and happy to be a part of the initiative. And the piece that we are primarily involved in is the intensive case management services. So what is CU Fresh Start? Basically, those individuals that are participating in it are told that they need to put their guns down. You put your guns down, take advantage of the opportunities that we're presenting to you to help you go down a different path in life, and it's a choice. You can decide you want to be a part of the program, and we will do everything we can to help you get further in life and to be able to lead a different path in life. If you choose not to and you are subsequently arrested for any type of gun violence, gun possession, then you will face the most severe consequences. So the people that we identify to be in the program, Dante will speak a little bit more about how that's done, but we wanted to kind of give you an overview of the criteria that they have to meet in order to be brought in for the call-in, which he'll also tell you a little bit more about. But basically the age group we're working with are young men 18 to 28 years old. They're either on probation or parole. They've had a prior arrest for a felony or some type of gun violence, gun possession, violent crime. And the law enforcement authorities have to have credible information of their involvement in any type of violent crime in the community. And Dante is going to take over from here and tell you a little bit more detail about the program.
Good evening again. Carol had mentioned the individuals that are identified for the program. So how that worked for our first call-in was law enforcement created a list of individuals in our communities that met those five criteria that was just mentioned. So back in late September, I think that number had reached 17. A couple of months prior to when they looked at the list, I think it had reached almost like 40. Individuals. So along those couple of months, some of the individuals did not make the list, whether they were had criminal involvement, moved out of town, or whatever the nature was, they were not on that list of 17. And so we primarily had Champaign and Urbana law enforcement, along with the sheriff department, identify those individuals. They presented 17 packets. We were not given names. What they basically presented us with was age, gender, if there was any type of clique or gang affiliation, and then a brief history on each one, which was consistent. When I say we, it was myself and two other members from the steering committee that were in the room with law enforcement. And so once law enforcement presented all 17 of those packets, they left the room, and it was up to the three individuals that were part of steering committee to decide which 12. We wanted to get at least or try to get 10 in that initial call-in, in each call-in. So we wanted to identify 12 individuals that could that would get invited to the call-in. So they left the room. We selected the 12. They came back in. And from that point, we had 12 to work with. On October 6th, we had our first call-in, and we had 9 individuals show up for the call-in. That was made possible through probation and parole as far as mandating them to attend the meeting, but they were not mandated to participate. So that's where a little bit of detail as far as who was in the room and how they got identified. And so what's important with Fresh Start is that there are 3 pillars that comprise CU Fresh Start. You have community, you have law enforcement, and you have services. Each pillar is vital to Fresh Start's efforts to be successful. So in regards to community pillar, this group is primarily responsible for humanizing the effects of violence by including family and friends of offenders, victim impact representatives, clergy, funeral directors, so on and so forth, and also including elected officials. The second pillar is law enforcement. And these individuals, they establish a clear criteria for us. They notify the offenders of, again, the legal consequences of gun violence, provide a clear opportunity to stop the shooting. They also follow up with swift, certain, severe consequences if they continue to engage in the same behaviors. And then the final pillar is the service pillar, in which that's where I come in. And again, like Carol mentioned, it's not just case management. It's not just making appointments. It's literally taking them and helping them navigate those appointments, showing them how to utilize time management and things of that nature, those basic skills that are needed in regards to navigating those things. So the call-in, some of you may have observed that, again, October 6th, and that's where we called the individuals in. They were sitting in front of a panel that consisted of both law enforcement slash government officials, as well as some community voices. So you had one of the mayors kicked it off. You had one of the chiefs of police spoke. You'll have someone that represents the federal prosecutor department. We'll have the sheriff department represented and the state's attorney. And then it switches over to the community voices. So you'll hear someone that has lived a violent life but has changed their life around. You'll hear from what's called the voices of pain or families of a victim. They'll hear from them. They'll hear from one of the pastors in the community. They'll hear from a funeral director. And then finally, they'll hear from myself before the second mayor wraps up the whole panel discussion. And so each individual is given up to 4 minutes to speak directly to the individuals. You also, in the back of the room, you have invited community individuals. A lot of those individuals came from the Champaign Coalition, those that have participated in that over the years, along with neighborhood groups, representatives from there. And we had some other groups that were identified we felt need to be a part of that first one. And so that list will change slightly as we have each call in, because we want to make sure those that are interested and have a buy-in to the community have an opportunity to witness that. The call-in serves as a chance for these individuals to learn about the police efforts in the community. So the overall message is, hey, individuals, I won't say gentlemen because there might be some young ladies at some point. You know, we as a community, we love you, but, again, this violence has to stop. You know, hopefully you'll make a choice to participate in this and be able to move forward with life. and leave the lifestyle that, that you're been participating in. And also provides information which can be conveyed to the members of their peer group, which has happened. We've had individuals that have participated with CU Fresh Start, and they have passed on information regarding jobs and other things to some of their friends. I've been on some home visits, and, you know, as family members are hearing me, they're bringing up some of their issues, and so that's also a time to share some of those resources. The call-ins are closed, so you cannot just walk in to the call-in. That's something that you have to be invited to. So, again, if interested, there's ways of communicating that. I report directly to Ms. Carroll here. We meet once a week at least. There's times where something may come up, and we meet more than once a week, but we are meeting at least once a week. Carol was absent due to some health concerns a couple of months ago, and so that's when I reported to Gail for that brief time. But Carol's back on board and been hitting it running, so glad to have her back. I am the liaison, and my work schedule is absolutely flexible. I can have my calendar planned in which Carol requires me, and I might get that phone call or that text. For example, today I planned on catching up on some notes, and I got a phone call from one of my individuals that just started out at Parkland, and he's excited, and he had an essay due. So I needed to get him to the library, and that's what I did. And so it has, you know, I have to be lenient as much as possible. I think that's helping build the relationship needed, and also so those individuals feel as though they have some sincere support. We do have a, and it's in the next paragraph, I didn't know that, but we do have a vehicle, a Prairie Center vehicle designated for CU Fresh Start specifically so that I can transport them to various places of appointments, whether it be court appointments, probation appointments, or whatever else may come up. So some of these intensive case management service include screening, planning, coordination, linkage agreements, advocating for them, and also monitoring their progress along the way. Purpose of the intensive case management service is to help the client handle aspects of their life that are not necessarily directly related to being referred to CU Fresh Start, but that it might impact whether the client has successful outcomes. This is a list of the individuals that are part of the steering committee. We have Tracy Parsons with Champaign Coalition, Chief Anthony Cobb, and Chief Pat Conley with both police departments. The U of I police chief, I forgot to put his name on there, but it's self-explanatory. A lot of the key stakeholders in this community are at one table, which is amazing, and I feel as though they have been very instrumental in the success of our first call-in and beyond. This has been a learning moment for us as we have had our first one and hoping to build as we move forward. For our first call-in, we did have 9 active participants. 5 of them came from probation, 4 from parole. We unfortunately had 2 participants that signed up but never really engaged in services. In regards to the number, and this is for October, we had 4 that were referred to employment, including agency, and 1 that was requiring assistance with court appointments. For November, that employment number stayed consistent, and that court appointment, as you can see, increased to 5. This was due to myself observing that all of our individuals, for the most part, had court appointments. We had 1 individual that had 3 different cases at the same time, and so just imagine keeping up with those multiple dates along with your probation appointment And so those are some of the things that I help provide. Again, just trying to help get them to their appointment. I'm not their lawyer or anything like that. But, again, it's been helpful for me knowing, like, what their specific probation requirements are, because those are things that Prairie Center can offer. And even if not, you know, such as, like, the drug screenings, also different groups that we offer at Prairie Center. But if not at Prairie Center, finding out where we can get those services to take care of those needs. For this last month of December, we still have 6 active participants. The 3 that are no longer a part of the program, they were removed due to parole violations for different sorts. To give you an example, we had an individual that was, you know, driving without a license. And so he was on parole, and, you know, parole got revoked or what have you, and had to deal with that consequences. And in a lot of cases, individuals, as we discussed in the steering committee, in a case like that, the individual did not go back to resorting to gun violence or what have you. So when he come back into the community, you know, those services will still be open to that individual. That was something that was discussed and agreed amongst the steering committee. So that December, I was able to reconnect the individual that was attending Parkland and had ended up stopped attending, and so had to go in there and navigate the system for him in regards to financial aid and also getting the hold up lifted off of his schedule. He started this week, so he's very excited about that. We have 2 that have enrolled for job training, 4 for employment. Employment could mean that they are actually working, in which we did have some that got hired, or they are enrolled and are linked and connected to an agency that is helping them secure employment as well. And like I said, all 6 of them are utilizing the court appointment services. We have 2 that are currently working on getting their driver's license, and we also have 2 that have done a drug assessment and are taking classes or doing whatever they need due to that, the outcome of the assessment. CU Fresh Start is a priority initiative of the Champaign Coalition, as it was mentioned earlier, and this is the website that you can go to learn how you can get involved. One more. And these are our connections in regards to Prairie Center, if you need any more information on that.
Any questions?
I'm just curious, when people enter this program and agree to put down guns, I think that's the phrase you use, is that a promise not to use guns, or do they also have to turn in firearms?
We have not required anyone to turn in firearms. What have to be realized is that not all the individuals with a gun conviction are considered, like, quote-unquote shooters or active shooting. It might have been a situation where there was a gun found in a vehicle, and somebody in that vehicle, you know, has to deal with that situation. And so all of them are not shooters. We are asking them to stay away from the gun violence and the guns. Law enforcement are doing their job as they normally do in regards to monitoring those behaviors. And so, again, the message is this is an opportunity for you to change your life around. If you're motivated to do that, then we can make that happen. There's other variables that I hear about that I know the rest of the community are not privy to. There are some with safety concerns. And you know, for example, we're asking one individual to put their gun down, but what about if there's a rival out there? You know, there's still that threat of safety. Not excusing that, but those are just variables that I hear about through different conversations.
I have a question on your list of services. Housing was not listed, so that's not an issue for these
housing
gentlemen?
Is one of the things that we do help with. It's just that right now none of them have identified housing as a top priority. So the reports that we showed you are what we would submit that shows what he's done each month so far.
Oh, okay.
So it could be that, you know, next month somebody says, hey, my girlfriend kicked me out. I don't have a place to stay.
Okay.
Then he would help them locate housing.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to ask, since there were parole violations, do you guys network with First Followers about their resources, or is that something you don't?
Yeah, we utilize, and I utilize all opportunities in regards to agencies, whether it be someone like First Followers, whether it be Illinois WorkNet on South Mattis or North Mattis, that offer various on-the-job training opportunities and job club. They also have once a month job fair. And so there are a couple of employers out there that are considered felony-friendly. So we utilize various outlets in regards to addressing the needs. In regard to housing, of course, everyone wants their own house. So there were, I think, four that did identify housing as that, but if we don't have any income coming in or collectively as a family, if it's just not feasible because we don't have the finances to do that, then there's other things we have to work on to get to that level there.
So you're working with six individuals successfully right now, and it's only been 3 or 4 months. The time frame for working with them, I assume, is long term, and then you're adding more. Could you talk about kind of that?
So, and this is a discussion that the steering committee had as well. We don't have a time frame, so the program is not a year-long program or a two-year program. It's based on the individual needs of each of the people involved in the program and their continued cooperation and not being involved in any further gun violence or gun arrest. So there's no timeline. He may work with one individual for 2 years, and that person has met all the goals that they've set for their service plan. They haven't had any further involvement. And then there may be someone else that he would work with longer. So it's really based on the individual's progress as to how long we work with them. Anything else?
Well, it's wonderful to get an update on Fresh Start. I know that there was a lot of discussion around the funding, and it's exciting to know that you're making a difference in at least six young men's lives, and I suspect it's a difference in many more lives because they have family, they have friends, they have community. So,
and we are actually planning our next call-in.
Great.
So we will have another group of young men. We have a couple of tentative dates. We just have to confirm participation by a couple of city officials as well as the venue. But we're looking at either February or March to do the next call-in. And so hopefully we will have another round of guys that we'll start working with.
And just for the record, the national average, I was told, is 30%. In regards to programs like this and individuals participating. And so out of nine, we still have six. And so We're in a wonderful place. Of course, you know, me personally, I want all of them, you know, to be successful, but that's not realistic. And again, I try to just focus on the motivation within an individual and build off of that.
Just one other question. What's the your capacity as you're having another round? What's the capacity for the number of people that you could handle?
So right now, what we wrote for the grant, our goal was to try and have at least 12 individuals. We thought that was a safe, conservative number, given this is our first year of doing this program. We would be more than happy if we exceed that. Of course, it is intensive case management services, so we're going to have to monitor the number because we want to make sure that he is able to have the flexibility and be able to go with them to appointments, advocate for them, and be a support. So that's something we're kind of looking at this first year to see what's really going to work. But in our application to CCMHB, we put 12 as our goal for this year.
So the question I was wondering, when you get six more coming in, are the six who stay going to help mentor in any way, or is it just going to be standalone groups?
Right now, I feel that it's going to be standalone. I do have individuals in mind that could eventually fill that role as far as being, you know, someone that can encourage the others. I'd even be interested in, for the next call-in, possibly utilizing some brief statements from them, you know, to the next group to just try and encourage them to participate just so they can talk about how it impacted their lives. You know, we do have to be considerate of confidentiality. And so I think that would be a nice way of trying to encourage the next group to come through, just to hear some of the success and how it impacted a couple of the individuals.
Well, first, thank you for an excellent presentation from both of you. This was very informative and very interesting for me, and I'm very encouraged that there's this kind of work going on in the community. This is real grassroots and real cooperative, so I'm very happy to hear that. I'm just curious, you're the only case manager for the group? It's a...
Yes.
What we used to call chief cook and bottle washer.
Yes.
And what is your call schedule? How much are you on call for these guys?
Well,
24/7.
I have a little 99-cent phone that stays on, and you know, and so I'm practicing boundaries.
I'm helping him. I'm helping him establish boundaries.
Yes, because I'm a late night owl myself, but I might get a text at 11:30, and it might not be urgent. But it's something that, you know, first thing in the morning or what have you, I'm responding. I'm making sure that the relationship is a genuine one, but at the same time, you know, when I'm on vacation, they know I'm on vacation, you know, and they respect that. But again, it's encouraging to get the text versus me having to chase individuals down or what have you. I mean, it shows just progress or someone just texting you Monday, hey, what's up? You know, they want to know what's the plan, you know, can we go get some more job applications in or whatever. So we do have that, and that's very encouraging for me.
I guess my question is, I saw the criteria that the age range is 18 to 28. Is there a reason that you guys do not consider minors for this program? I understand it might be a complicated response, so if you give a generalized answer, that might be appropriate so that we're not here all night. And also, just in a generally speaking, is there the belief that when we see with the gun violence that we are seeing locally, are there a lot of individuals who are underage? I know we've seen in Chicago there's been a lot of individuals who are underage who are partaking in this violence, but is that something we're also seeing here?
The age group 18 to 28, from my understanding, individuals that are beyond that, you know, it gets a little gray. If you've reached that age and still involved in some of those behaviors, it's going to be real challenging trying to reach you. In regards to younger individuals, my background is school social work, and so I always have the young people in mind with whatever I do. And so, again, that was a conversation in today's supervision, like, is that possible? Because I think it is important that they might not be able to be a part of CU Fresh Start, but how can we tailor something to fit those needs in regards to going to, like, inside of JDC or into the school district? So that's something that's a fresh conversation between me and Carol ourselves.
We're always looking to the future. So one of the things we've talked about is, just like there's a prevention program for substance abuse, wouldn't it be nice if we had a prevention program for anti-violence and what's out there? So I gave him some homework, because when you come to me with ideas, you got to do some research. So what's already being offered out there, because we don't need to duplicate services? Is there a service gap or service need that needs to be filled with that age group? My understanding is that the coalition identified the 18 to 28-year-old age group because typically they are not targeted or identified to receive social services and support. And also, that is the age group that some of the research shows is involved in the serious crimes, violent crimes, gun violence. Now, as for our particular community, especially right now with the spate of shootings that have occurred, it has seemed to go towards more of that age group, but even a little younger. And that may just be unique to our community, I don't know. But my understanding is initially the 18 to 28-year-old age group was the group that law enforcement identified as having the highest occurrence of those violent shootings, crimes, serious crimes.
Question, Mark?
This is not a question. I just want to give a shout out to Mr. Lotz in terms of, he mentioned his background in being a school social worker. In between being a school social worker and the position he's in now, he was a Parenting with Love and Limits therapist at Prairie Center, working with youth involved with the Juvenile Detention Center.
Thank you so much for your report. It was very interesting, affirming, and makes us happy to know that some of the fun.
Thank you all. We appreciate your support.
It's already 7:10. I just want to move us along a little bit. The next order of business is Code of Ethics, and I asked Len to insert the Code of Ethics. It's towards the back on page 44. We aren't going to read through it right now, but it's there as a reminder for all of the board members that we do have a Code of Ethics, and again, we see these things usually when we're appointed at the beginning, and then we don't see it again. So please take a few minutes to read through it and determine, you know, if you feel that you're able to respond to the 12 items that are listed in the Code of Ethics.
Can I ask a couple questions about it?
Absolutely.
I think it's probably just an oversight. Or should up there in the first paragraph, I guess it'd be four lines from the bottom, if you count include as the first mm-hmm. line at the bottom, which says best interests of people with disabilities. It doesn't say mental health needs and or disabilities. Wouldn't that be
absolutely
more appropriate? I think it's probably because yes. It's taken from the other board's Code of Ethics is what I'm guessing.
Yes.
So that's
we
one
have
thing.
A broader population. You're right. Uh-huh.
The other question I have is number 10. I don't quite understand how we fulfill that if we do board-to-board visits. So just in order to be picky about it, we probably need some way that we say this in that, so that that's covered. I mean, I understand the spirit of the intention, but literally speaking, it would be difficult to do that.
If you added the word privately after communicate, would that do it?
So instead of being a public sitting at the board meeting, for instance, I would go to Rosecrans and sit at their community board meeting.
Yeah, that would work.
I wouldn't be saying anything about what we're funding, and I wouldn't have a private conversation with.
If that captures the spirit of it, then that's fine.
Might.
It's just want to make sure that, because
yeah.
you know,
good
you go
point.
To one of these things and things come up, and
right.
there is even publicly there's some sort of conversation. So I didn't want to inadvertently violate the rules here.
Anna.
Yeah, I have a question. Where does this come from? Where do these codes of ethics come from? Are they from other boards, or we had this for a long time, or is it from the state? Or
I think this is a draft document, right? It's really guidelines at this point.
It, I think it's involves both boards, so it's relatively recent, within the last 8 years. But in terms of how where it was pulled from, I know one of the things I looked at, and just recently even, was, for example, what United Way uses. So in terms of where these points came from, I would say it came out of the work of the previous executive director. I would imagine it probably was something similar to, like, you know, looking at, for example, what I did with United Way, but also looking at what possibly other 708 boards did. But I can't definitively say describe the origin of this.
That's what I remember, too.
I think we talked about it as a team and didn't bring it to the board for approval or signature. It's really guidelines that were developed. There's a parallel set of code of ethics for county, so it may have a relationship to that. Is that what you remember too, Stephanie?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess I also had a question about number 10. I know I'm new to the board, so if you could maybe provide me an example of what this would be referring to, because when I read board members shall not communicate with persons under consideration for selection by the board or executive director for contracts, to me that sort of sounds like it's saying that we can't talk to the agencies that we were working with.
And that was not the intent. The intent was not to have private or side conversations where you would be suggesting extra representation or preference, or so, which would possibly come up in private conversations, which is, I think, why Elaine brought up the term private. So, for instance, we just had a conversation with the people from Prairie Center, and they will be submitting, I suspect, a proposal. And it was a very public conversation, and it was appropriate so that we know what's happening with the new project, new funding. Does that make sense?
How would we define a private conversation? I'm sorry to cause so much trouble on my first.
Yeah,
meeting.
No, I think I read this through, and it all looked so kind of general to me that my initial reaction was, if we had this as a code of ethics and there was an individual on the board that we wanted to get rid of, we could get rid of them based on any of these things. You could get rid of me, you could get rid of anybody, because these are so general and you could be interpreted. So I guess my suggestion is this needs to go back to the drawing board. If we need to have a code of ethics, which we might need to have, that's why I'm saying, why do we have to have this? You know, who's saying we have to have this? If we have to have it, then we should have something that we all want to live with. You don't want to put something in a code of ethics or in a contract or anything that is going to turn around and bite you in the behind.
Okay.
everybody here has good intent. I know they all do. But at some points in the future, that may not always be the case.
Yes.
Yeah,
Jillian.
I understand that point. And what I would say also, though, is that I don't know why I knew this, but I think it might have been from a conversation with the previous director, but someone approached me. This is an example. Someone approached me with a perfectly reasonable set of questions about something they wanted to do, a program they wanted to, I can't remember if it was Get Started or Get, and I just realized as soon as they started talking to me, and what I was able to say without necessarily being rude about it or dismissive was that actually you really need to talk to the executive director about that rather than individual board members because we can't discuss those things outside of our meetings. I do think it is appropriate to have some sort of however it's worded, some sort of clear understanding. At least I'll speak for myself here. I know a lot of people. I've been around this community a long time. I've been involved in many, many things. And many people, once they discover that I'm on this board, suddenly have great interest in me. I feel like it makes me feel like I'm sort of the rich guy, you know. But so I don't want to get myself in a situation where I'm either, dismissive or impolite or yet also, and I want to be helpful, but I don't want to do things that would be really unfair. So I do need, it is useful to have some sort of guidelines about how to handle certainly those situations.
In terms of why did it show up this month, I was talking with Lynn about the board meeting and the amount of time that I thought we had, and said it's been a long time since we've talked about something like a code of ethics or bylaws or whatever. And could you find it and see what we have? And so this happened to be the month to pull the code of ethics. Now, we certainly could request that staff engage in editing or looking at other examples of code of ethics, or we could set up a small subcommittee of board members to do that. It was primarily to generate some conversation on the board about how we interact and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. So any suggestions?
I think one suggestion I would make is to change, because we were just talking about the 10, is that board members will refer questions about contracts to the executive director or assistant director. Because then I think that takes us, I mean, this is, like Julian said, it's a small community. People are going to come up and ask us questions. I always say, call Mark. But we're also that person that people feel comfortable coming up and asking, and we may not be able to, just because that keeps us from, just to say, I'm not in a position to really help you on that, but contact. You know, just talking to him is not communicating me. It's like, well, that's we all communicate with each other, and we hope that agencies feel comfortable talking to us about things too.
Yeah. I got the microphone here. I suggest that we table this. This wasn't really an action item. It was just a point of information. But now that I know that this document exists, I'm taking it a little bit more seriously. And especially in this bizarre climate that we have in this country right now in terms of ethics, it seems like we should take it seriously for ourselves on the grassroots level where we are. So maybe we can have a small group of people reword this and come up with something that they can present to the board maybe in a couple months or something like that. And I'm not very good at doing emails, but I would be willing to help with that.
Could I get two more volunteers to work with Ann on that?
Okay. I'll do it. Okay. Especially if we're going to do it on email.
On email. And then, of course, I'll do it too. So that gives us three. Lynn wants to make a suggestion.
I think the timing is really interesting, too. While we have consultants on contract to do this organizational assessment, this actually is their area. Yeah. One of them was a director of a 708 board for 30 years, and he's been consulting with 708 boards ever since. So I think including him in your discussions of what to do with this would be great, and he would do it, I think.
Amen.
We actually have them through the entire year. It's just like very small amounts of time later.
Yeah.
I think it's important to know that I've been on other boards where we have signed a code of ethics. And I think if you look at the intent of this is to be respectful. It's very good intent. So thanks.
Yeah. I think probably we could make it a lot shorter.
Probably.
I think probably some of the concerns that Ann expressed might be that it's just got too many words and too many things in it. We could probably get it down to a much more focal.
Thank you very much. Old business, we have a schedule for our meetings. Lynn, do you want to quickly go through that? It's page 46, 47.
Well, we've got, so it's not on here, but next Wednesday we can do that study session that we talked about earlier. I know it's unfortunate that a couple of you can't be here, but I think it would be, if some of you are interested, we're ready to have that conversation with you. It's good timing for us. Applications are due February 10, so for all of us to be preparing ourselves at the end of January is great. Then there's another optional study session. They're not listed in here, but they're usually 1 or 2 weeks right after a board meeting you could either pick one that's in the future for a topic that we should coordinate, or if you want to have continued discussion from a meeting, you could say, you know, next week we do want that study session. So otherwise, what this shows you is sort of the staff expectation of where we will be completing tasks and bringing them to you. And then the sort of the purpose of each regularly scheduled meeting, that's usually associated with tasks, but sometimes it's completely independent of staff tasks, like the liaison assignments will be done in February. That's always the president coordinating that. So hopefully that we can actually look at that next week, too, and talk about each of the steps.
And it's a six-month schedule, not a full-year schedule. It gets us through the funding, which is the purpose, to July 1. And we'll have a longer schedule at some point for August through December. Well, April and May is when we start making the decisions. The grants go out in July. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Did you want to bring that up?
I did want to bring up that I'm unfortunately going to be out of town for two of the meetings, April 19th and May 17th. Certainly, Elaine could take over both of those meetings. However, I was wondering if there would be flexibility on the board to shift the May meeting to either a week earlier.
The next week? As a day we have the room?
We have the room also for 5:24. I'm going to be in Hong Kong for 2 weeks.
Oh, okay.
So
you would want to do it earlier?
How about the 24th instead?
We may just need to stick with it for the 17th. I may be the only person who's going to be absent, but we'll have study sessions and conversations.
Okay. Is that the meeting where we do the final vote?
Usually the final vote is June, but we get very close to finalizing the decisions.
Actually,
we do the draft budget in June.
Well, we present the allocation recommendations to at that regular May meeting. We have, in the last couple of years, needed to have another meeting after that to discuss some of the pieces that weren't finalized. So So it's on the schedule as the date to do the allocation decisions, but we can address them again after that. We have to have finalized contracts, which means finalized contract negotiations by June 30th. So that's the negotiations take a minute. So if we could use the optional study session, or we could use an early June date, maybe, mm-hmm. to complete the decisions about allocations, that gives us enough time to do contract negotiations.
When do we vote? Which one are you?
May 17th.
Other items on the agenda? We're down to the bottom, I think. Agency acronym lists. I think that's become a regular inclusion so that you can speak the language of MHB and some new acronyms. Are there any board announcements? No board announcements? Okay. A reminder that we have a study session next week, 5:37. And thank you all. Thank the new members for coming. I think that do we need to vote to adjourn?
I move to adjourn.
I second.
All those in favor? Okay, we are adjourned.
All right.